placed hooks. Well, I never. Well, earlier on this week, fully clothed, I hasten to add, I met up with Bob Lind. He came into the BBC Radio 6 music studio and we talked about his career, writing and stuff like that. I've been a fan of his music for a long time. We'll hear some of his stuff and we'll also hear from, well, other people. I won't spoil it for you. But anyway, sit back and enjoy the conversation with Mr. Bob Lind. It gives me a great pleasure to welcome to the Sunday service today Mr. Bob Lind. Hello, Bob.
Hello, Jarvis. How are you?
I'm not too bad. Thank you for joining me. You're in the middle of a tour here in the UK, aren't you?
Yes, I am.
So thanks for taking the time out to come here. I was looking through the booklet to your new CD today, and I was very excited to see a paragraph which I'm going to attempt to read. God, my eyesight's getting so bad now. Please listen to the songs all the way through before reading the lyrics. Reading the words while you listen for the first time is like consulting a sex manual while you're making love. Now, you're a man after my own heart, Mr. Lind, because I've always put, you put it more poetically there. I always put on lyric sheets, do not read the lyrics whilst listening to the record. Pray tell me, what's your reason for that?
I saw that on We Love Life. Hmm. I just have always felt that way. I find myself, when I do it, when I listen to somebody sing and I have the lyrics, without even meaning to, I'm jumping ahead and I miss the impact of the line. Mm. It's not so bad like on YouTube when they do it as they sing it. But whenever I see the lyrics, I'm involved in it. It takes away from the impact of just hearing the way the artist is going to present it to me. And as I say, maybe I'm three lines down and I'm tapping my fingers, you know, patting my foot, waiting for him to get to where I am. It ruins it for me. Mm.
Yeah, because I guess the words are there. You're kind of taking them out of the context that they've been put into before you've even heard the song, haven't you? You're kind of putting them in a quite a dry environment. Because words have got their own. When you read something, you've got the rhythms of speech there. But obviously, if it's in a song, it's going to be kind of involved with the rhythm of the song then.
And often when you read a lyric, it looks like it doesn't work because the meter, so often the melody, that's the difference between poetry and lyrics. Mm. You know, that's why I'm grateful to accept the mantle of lyricist, but I'm not a poet. I write poetry. Mm. But there are some great poets out there. As lyricists, we have the melody. We have the melody to help us out, to give the words impact. That's why guys like Jimmy Webb can write, "Someone left a cake out in the rain," which looks ridiculous if you read it.
Yeah.
"Someone left, and I don't think I can take it, because it took so long to bake it." Looks ridiculous when you read it. But he knew that. He knew that with the power of that melody and where it comes, there's an impact with that, that you're, even as you're laughing, you feel that stirring in your gut, which, you know, poets don't have that luxury.
Spring was never waiting for us, girl. It ran one step ahead as we followed in the dance. Between the parted pages and were pressed love's hot fevered iron, like a striped pair of pants. Father's bark is melting in the dark, all the sweet green icing falling down. Someone left the cake out in the rain. I don't think that I can take it, cause it took so long.
You say you write poetry as well, and you also write prose. How do you make the distinction that, okay, this is going to be a poem and this is going to be a lyric?
Well, for one thing, I don't write poetry very often, so I'm not very good at it. But mostly, when I write songs, I'll be fooling with my guitar, fooling on the piano, and a phrase will jump at me, like a melodic phrase with a lyric, little snatch of lyric. And then I kind of build on that and see where it feels. When I'm writing a poem, I don't know why I choose the poem instead of the lyric, but there are some great poems. You know, I mean, there are very few of my lyrics that I could recite. But there are poets like, you know, Bukowski and Billy Collins and Ted Kooser and Sharon Bryan who can tear your heart out with just what's on the page, you know. Sharon Bryan, let me tell you one. This is called Beyond Recall. Nothing matters to the dead. That's what's so hard for the rest of us to take in. Their complete indifference to our enticements, our attempts to get in touch. They're not observing us from a discreet distance. They're not listening to a word we say. You know that, but you don't believe it. Even deep in a cave, you don't believe in total darkness. You keep waiting for your eyes to adjust and reveal your hand in front of your face. So how long a silence will it take to convince us that we're the ones who don't exist, as far as X is concerned, and Y, that they've forgotten every little thing they knew about us, what we told them, and what we didn't have to. Even our names mean nothing to them now. Our throats ache with all we might have said next time we saw them. Now that's a poem, you know, to me. That's a beautiful poem because it's even past the words, you know. That's why poetry often translates so bad from one language to another. Because there's an impact, to me, in those words that are past just the sum of their black and white parts.
Yeah, poetry also, you don't have to get it straight away, do you? That's often, you're saying sometimes it's the sound of it, maybe the rhythm of it kind of gets something across. And also,
yeah,
I suppose that's why sometimes people get impatient with poetry, because nowadays people kind of want information to come straight here and just kind of reveal itself straight away. With a poem, sometimes you might read it, not really get it. A year later, maybe you'll read it again and suddenly, or maybe it'll come back into your mind and that phrase will somehow chime or ring true for you.
Plus, people want information in a linear way. They want it to make a logical sense. To me, there's just a resonance in poems by Billy Collins or Bukowski that you feel. And once in a while, that's true. I'll read a poem and I'll completely miss it. And then come back to it and say, oh, yeah. And who knows? It might not even be that I've matured to it. It might be just the mood I was in or the time, you know.
You mentioned Charles Bukowski there. I was doing my extensive research, which is always just a look on Wikipedia. And it claimed on Wikipedia that you knew Charles Bukowski and maybe were also featured in some of his work under an alias.
Yeah, yeah. Whenever Bukowski writes about you, he's always going to be the star. He's going to be the alpha male, and anybody he writes about, any other man that he writes about, is going to be like a cast of thousands to him. But yes, I'm in the book. I can't even say I am, because his character's nothing like me, really. It's just based on some incidents that, you know, I was at his house on New Year's Eve one night with his girlfriend and him, and playing my songs, and I had done a show where I opened for him, you know, which he set up. You know, he's a very gracious guy. People don't realize that. They just think he's this fiery drunk, you know. But he had a great heart, you know. But when he writes about you, he's always gonna kind of trivialize you. He's never, you know, he's always got to have the biggest one on the block, you know. And this was back when I was when I got sober. Of course, you can't hang out with Bukowski when you're sober, you know. Right. So, but this was in the heart of my drinking, and I found him to be a really generous man.
The secret of my endurance. I still get letters in the mail. Mostly from crack-up men in tiny rooms with factory jobs or no jobs, who are living with whores or no women at all. No hope, just booze and madness. I get most of their letters on lined paper, written with an unsharpened pencil or in ink, in tiny handwritings that slant down to the left. And the paper is most often torn, usually halfway up the middle. And they say they like my stuff. I've written from where it's at. They recognize it truly. I've given them some chance, some recognition of where it's at. It's true, I was there, even worse off than most of them. But I wonder if they realize where their letter arrives. Well, it is dropped into a box on a wire fence behind a 6-foot hedge and a long driveway to a 2-car garage, rose garden, fruit trees, animals, a beautiful woman, mortgage about half paid after years residence, a new car, 2 cars, fireplace and a green rug 2 inches deep, with a young boy to write my stuff now. I keep him in a 10-foot square cage with a typewriter. Feed him whiskey and raw horse. Belt buckle him pretty good 3 or 4 times a week. I'm 60 years old now, and the critics say my stuff is getting better than ever.
It seems that, I never met him, but it's astonishing that people think, oh yeah, Charles Bukowski, drinking, womanizing all the time, but the amount of work that he put down, that's amazing. I mean, he couldn't have been doing that all the time because he wouldn't have had time to write and get all that stuff down.
There were mornings when I woke up. Sometimes his parties would go on. I mean, it sounds like there's some kind of F. Scott Fitzgerald stuff, you know, but when he would have people over, you know, be a small amount of people, we'd just pretty much drink all night. And at the end of the night, Bukowski and I would be the only ones on our feet. But when I finally crashed, I mean, I was out. And the next morning and most of the next day, I was incapacitated. But Bukowski would wake up at 10 o'clock, 9 o'clock, and he would sit down at that typewriter, and he would work. And he would work under conditions that, you know, I just can't imagine. Mm. And yes, he's a very disciplined writer, like Hemingway. People think the same thing about Hemingway. You know, he went fishing, he got drunk, you know, he chased the ladies, but he was a disciplined writer, and so was Bukowski.
Talk about writing. You kind of touched on songwriting a little bit. Do you have any kind of routine, or is it a case of waiting for an idea to come, or you sit down at a certain time in a day? Or
I've done it all kinds of ways, Jarvis. Mm. I've done it where I've set aside time to write, and I've counted on inspiration, and there's no one thing that seems to work for me. But I do like piano. I'm a terrible piano player. I'm awful. But I can find things on a piano that inspire me in ways that my guitar playing doesn't, you know. And so I'll often get my ideas and write songs on the piano, and then I'll transfer them to guitar. But I think there has to be a time in every songwriter's life when that's all you do. You're consumed with it. When I was like 19, my whole life was writing song. I would wake up in the morning, I would drink some coffee and take some uppers, and I would sit down at this kitchen table, and I would write 6-7 songs a day. Now, they were awful songs. I didn't think they were awful. Mm. You know, this is pushing Shakespeare right off the map. These things are great because drugs will give you that kind of confidence. However, the value that they had is they taught me to write. You know, and then at night I would go out and hear music, and then I would come back and crash, and I would get up and start. And, you know, at the end of the day, the whole kitchen table would be full of lyrics, and, you know. Now, I have waned somewhat in that kind of, I think you can't, it's like romance, you know. When you're first in love, everything is sex, everything is romance, and your nerve ends are tingling with it. But you can't sustain that. You could sustain it, you burn your nerves out. But that was my education, you know, and that and listening. I think it's really important to listen.
We've talked about lyrics a bit, about you not wanting people to read the lyrics whilst listening to the record. I suppose from my relationship with your music, part of that was your use of lyrics that I found interesting and certainly was an inspiration to me. For people who don't know, there's a Pulp song called Bob Lind, The Only Way Is Down, on Pulp's last record, which was released in 2002, which was an attempt to rip off one of your songs, actually. There's a song called Truly Julie's Blues. And what fascinated me about that song was the kind of tension between the lyrics and the music. The music was quite pacey and sounded fairly jaunty, even, could I say. But the lyrics were really quite dark about, you know, when everything... I've got it here, actually. Would you mind if I played it?
No.
Yeah? Let's listen to it, and then we could maybe talk about it a little bit. This is Truly Julie's Blues. Truly Julie's Blues, as sung by my guest on the Sunday service today, Mr. Bob Lind. And we were talking about lyric writing and stuff. As I say, that was an inspiration to me, the thing of putting quite dark lyrics with a fairly kind of jaunty tune. And was that something that you did on purpose? Or?
Oh, no, I never did any of that on purpose. Everything I wrote, and this hasn't changed from today, it comes from some source. I don't know where it is. And it sounds so precious and phony to say that, you know. Well, you know, the songs are out there, and you just sort of become a channel. I think the only thing that's allowed me to achieve whatever level of artistic success that I have is just doing it, practicing, doing it. But there was no conscious effort there. Often I don't know what a song is going to be about until I start doing it, you know, until I start working on it. And then I get it. And then I have to, of course, go back and rewrite and shape and refine. But no, I to tell you the truth, it was so long ago, Jarvis. You know, as I was listening to this song there, I kind of liked it, you know. But as you know, this is no secret. I'm not crazy about my older stuff. Mm. It's not that I don't like it. That's a common mistake. People think, oh, he hates his old stuff. I really don't. It's more like... you're 13, 14 years old, and you think you're cool, and you have your hair a certain way, and you get a picture taken. Well, you know, by the time you're 20, you don't want that picture shown around, not because you were embarrassed to be who you were then, but because people think that's who you are. They say, oh, yeah, I know Bob Lynn. That's him. Well, it really isn't, you know. I've moved since then. I mean, I'm so excited about this new album, you know. It's the only time, we talked about it a little bit before the show, that I can really feel like I can say, here, give somebody some. This is what I do.
It's interesting, the kind of essay that you've written at the start of the booklet says, starts off, I hate recording. Yeah. So you've got to have quite an understanding record label going to allow you to put that in the book.
I never thought that they might, but, you know, I go on to say nice things about them, so maybe they weren't too eager to edit me, you know. But, yeah, what happens with records is that they nail you. You'll understand this when you're older, young man. When your old stuff starts to define you in many people's eyes, and you say, I didn't stop there. I didn't die. I've continued to grow. I've continued to evolve. Please listen to what I'm doing now. I do a lot of my older things on stage, but I do them different now because I feel them differently. And if people get too tied to the way they hear a record, then they're going to want to hear that record duplicated, you know? Mm. If you go to hear Billy Joel do Just the Way You Are, you want to hear that sax solo. And
I don't know about that.
Yeah.
I'm a bit allergic to sax, but anyway, I get what you're saying.
Yeah, okay. But... But yeah, you know, the general idea is that people, and I'm fortunate to have an audience now who is not glued to that, you know. There are two kinds of people who come to hear me play. People who want to relive their memories of when they were young and not fat and not bald and when romance was new. And they say, oh, I remember what I was doing when I heard Elusive Butterfly. Well, that's fine. Anybody who wants to hear me for any reason is good. But I'm also attracting a younger audience, and we're right around the same maturity level, you know. I mean, I'm 70 years old, but I don't think like most 70-year-olds that I know. They've got grandkids. They've got, they're getting their medicines from Canada. Their life is totally different. It's wrapped up in their kids and grandkids, you know. I was married for 10 years, no kids. I still feel things as passionately as I did when I was 16, 17. So the things that I'm writing now have less impact for people my age than they do people in their 20s and 30s.
Hmm. And tell me how this record came about, because you kind of ducked out of the recording business around the beginning of the 70s. Mm-hmm. So there was a long time when you didn't release any records. So how did this return come about?
Well, what I care about is putting asses in chairs. That's what I care about, performing, being in a venue and having people come to hear me. And you can't really do that without records. And I knew for 40 years that I had to put out a record soon. And I'd talk to producers and it wouldn't work out for various reasons. And then I connected with Jamie Hoover. He's not very well known over here, but in America, he has a cult band called the Sponge Tones.
Right.
And they do this kind of Beatles-esque pop rock, you know. But he's a dynamite guitar player and a dynamite bass player. And he loves my music. He's been a lifelong fan. And, you know, as it says in the album notes, I didn't really plan to do a CD with him. But we just started playing. I would send him a song. He would do some repairs. The record would come back to me, and I would be amazed at what he'd done. So eventually we just decided, all right, let's do this together.
Where are these songs taken from? Did you carry on writing songs all that time?
For the most part, they're relatively new.
If you had to select one to lay on us right now, what would...
Oh, boy.
Come on.
Can we play How Dare You Love Me, the first one on the...
Of course.
Okay.
Track one on the Bob Lynn CD, Finding You Again. This is How Dare You Love Me. How dare you?
You're wearing away the wall. just push back and resist. My pride is tight in my fist, but you endure and persist. How dare you love me like this? How dare you love me? Don't you care how your fingers are torn as you reach through these brambles and thorns? There's a long list of women who built me this shield, and I hold it to guard me from harm. But lifting it keeps getting harder to do with the tug of your hand on my arm. How dare you love me so bold? How dare you love me so tough? When will the struggle get old? When will enough be enough? How dare you love me so brave? What is there in me to save? How dare you love me? Behind my back they call me Jericho, and I know you know what they do. I feel the cracks, I hear the trumpets blow as a brand new world rumbles through. And you love me, you love me. I can't believe you love me. I just can't understand why you reach and reach again for the battle-weary hands of this dark and damaged man. But take me if you can, and dare to love me.
From the new CD, Finding You Again, that's How Dare You Love Me, by my guest on the Sunday service today, Bob Lind. Another thing that it says in the booklet, Bob, is that you don't like recording. You don't enjoy the process of recording.
Right.
But I thought your reasons for that were quite interesting, and wonder if you'd share those with the listeners.
Well, for one thing, I'm too impatient. Music to me is about performing. It's an immediate thing. You know, we were talking before the show about, you know, I love to see the audience. I like that. I get a read, sort of. It's a give and take. Mm. And recording for me, you know, I've been in the room with great recording artists. I've seen Nilsson, you know, I've been in the studio when he's recorded. And these people who are really recording artists see it as a separate art. And it is. It's a separate art. And I'm not very good at it. One is my impatience, and the other is, I think we talked a little bit about it before, it's in stone then. When you put the record down, because on stage, you know, you've seen me enough to know that I don't do the things the same way from moment to moment or show to show, and I don't want to be tied into that. So, you know, that's really two kind of lame reasons, but, you know, when I do my demos, I just say, okay, get the song down. And people will listen to it, and I don't have to, don't realize it, you know. These people have to work to get the song from my recording, where they wouldn't if I was playing it for them. Right? If I had a guitar right now and was playing for you, it would be so different than if I played one of my demos for you.
So it's kind of like the recording process, in a way, kills the song. It kind of stops it at one stage of its development, and then that's it for the rest of time.
Yeah, that's right, but with me, it does have an afterlife. There's a ghost of it remaining because I play the songs live.
Well, let's talk about you, because you're in the middle of a tour. You're going to play. We're speaking on Tuesday afternoon. You're going to play London this evening.
Right.
How's it been going? The playing.
Great. This is what I love to do. This is what I live to do, man. To play. And to get out and do my music. I don't do it enough, but I love, because, you know, it's not always opportunities. But yes, I'm playing London tonight and then Sheffield and seeing our friend Richard at Sheffield, Richard Hawley. And then look at me drop these names, man. I'm so shameless. And then Manchester and then Bristol. And then there's a few days off, and then I'm going to Spain and play Bilbao and Madrid.
And I saw you at the end of the Road Festival, and like you said, we were discussing, it was quite bright in the room, and I was saying I would be scared by that, because I like to know an audience is there, but I don't want to see the faces too clearly. But you kind of like that.
And I love it.
And also the thing of just getting up, you know, you get up on stage, it's you and the guitar, and that's it. You've got no other members of a band to kind of shield you or anything like that. It's just, but
or hamper
it seems
me.
That you really kind of get you like that kind of, you know, it's like bareback riding or something. You
intimacy, yeah. Immediacy. I do. That's what music is for me. The less layers of separation between me and the people I'm singing to, the better. And there were like 1,000 people in that room, but it felt so personal. This is an audience that you don't always get. People who are there to that end of the Road Festival is a wonderful festival. I mean, there's not very many, I don't know of any festivals in America that are like it, because they usually have names and then they stick locals up, you know, but basically they're selling the names and, you know, oh, we're going to hear the Doobie Brothers or whatever, and then we'll hear some local band. But the end of the Road Festival doesn't seem to be at all star driven, they're art driven. So that the people who came to hear me because they wanted to. Except the traitors who ducked out to see David Byrne.
Well, that's the other thing of festivals. You have some, but it wasn't too bad, actually. So, you know, sometimes you get that thing where you're playing a nice, quiet song and then a kind of thrash metal band goes on at the tent next door and all you can hear is and you're trying to play a tender ballad or something.
No, they're terrific. The people at the end of the road were terrific. All the shows, all the gigs that I've been doing have been wonderfully organized.
Brilliant. Well, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you, Jarvis.
Cease to know or to tell or to see or to be your own.